Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 20th of July. Our main stories. The UK has condemned Iran after Revolutionary Guards seized a British oil tanker. A second vessel was also briefly detained. And the Kosovan Prime Minister has resigned after being called for questioning as a war crime suspect. Also in this podcast...
We're not available in China, we're not available in Sudan, we're not available in a bunch of markets where we've been unable to work with governments to agree a set of rules that don't subject us to censorship.
A warning from YouTube over regulation. Ever since British Marines seized an Iranian oil tanker near Gibraltar earlier this month on suspicion of breaching EU sanctions, Tehran has threatened retaliation. And on Friday, it carried out its threat, forcing a British vessel, the Stena Impero, to divert into Iranian waters after accusing it of violating international maritime rules. A second vessel was also boarded. As he went into an emergency meeting a little earlier, the British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt issued this statement.
Well, the situation as we see it this evening is a situation involving two vessels. The first is the Stena Impero, which was surrounded by four vessels and a helicopter, has changed course and is heading into Iranian waters. The second ship, the Mesdar, Liberian flagged but British managed, surrounded by 10 speedboats. It's not clear yet whether it has changed course or not. That has 25 crew. No British nationals in any of the crew, but we're obviously concerned about all of the crew. This is completely unacceptable. Freedom of navigation must be maintained. We are having an emergency meeting of the government's COBRA committee in a few minutes' time. We will respond in a way that is considered but robust. And we are absolutely clear that if this situation is not resolved quickly, there will be serious consequences.
The British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt. It later emerged that the second ship, the Mesdar, was allowed to continue its journey after Iranian guards warned the crew about safety and environmental issues. The Stena Impero remains in Iranian hands, having been taken to a coastal area and handed over to the authorities. Our defence and diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus is monitoring developments.
Well, now, clearly, I think the government will be relieved that it's only a single vessel that seems to be in play, held by the Iranian authorities. Now, of course, there has to be a negotiation. Mr. Hunt was quite clear. It's diplomatic means that are going to resolve this crisis. He wants it resolved quickly. And one has to say that since this is a specific bilateral row between London and Tehran, which comes very much in the wake of Britain's arrest of the tanker carrying Iranian oil off the coast of Gibraltar at the start of this month. One imagines some kind of deal whereby each of the two tankers are effectively exchanged probably is the way forward. But it's a very unfortunate episode. And of course, it comes against the much broader tensions in the Gulf region, pitting the United States against Iran.
Yeah, with the Iranians producing video earlier today trying to prove that the US hadn't shot down a drone, which President Trump claimed yesterday. It does seem a very dangerous area to operate an oil tanker at the moment, but I guess they don't have any option.
Well, it's hugely dangerous. We've had attacks on several ships already with Limpet mines. Remember an American unmanned drone, quite an expensive, a very large one, was shot down by the Iranians not so long ago. So the tension is huge. There are very crowded shipping lanes. It's a very narrow waterway. There's a lot of military hardware in the region, both Iranian and then US warships, aircraft, along with some ships from other nations. So it's a real tinderbox, and all you need is a spark with things going badly wrong, and this could turn from a series of diplomatic episodes into something much more serious.
Jonathan Marcus talking to me earlier. As you may have heard in our podcast yesterday, our Middle East correspondent Martin Patience has recently been to Iran to assess the mood of the nation as it grapples with tougher sanctions and rising international tensions. As with all foreign media in Iran, the team was accompanied by officials from the government, but there was no restriction on what he could say. His latest report is from Darakeh in Tehran.
We're on a gravel path in a popular hiking spot in the city. And you can see why. In front of me is just the green of trees. Beneath us is a mountain stream. The air up here feels clean. And this is a popular spot for both young and old who want to take to the mountains and leave the city behind them. What's your name?
Mohammed.
How is life at the moment in Iran? The tensions between America and this country. Is that making your life difficult?
Who's not suffering?
It affects
everything. You know, it even affects the hiking because you need to buy equipment for climbing, like this clipper here. He said he can buy it, but now it's four times more.
So it's gone up four times in price. Are you worried that there could be a conflict between America and Iran? No? You said that definitively, no. Why?
War would never happen because it's not only about people getting killed, pains that you will suffer, you know, all these problems. It's about cost. It's not justifiable, it's not reasonable for none of the parties to enter into a war.
We're passing a shop on one of the trails. What's he asking if we want tea?
It's ash.
Ash?
It's a vegetable soup.
And this is a traditional soup? Thank you, sir. It's beautiful. The man serving the soup is called Hadi. What's the one thing Donald Trump and his administration don't understand about Iran?
We Iranians have a very long history. We have a long background of civilization. And we have this type of honor in our blood that we as Iranians are always standing against all the difficulties. Iranian people are actually not like what they think. They think if they put sanctions on us, they would start rioting. But we have our national unity, and the more difficult the situation is, the more united the people become.
Well, we're continuing our climb, and the view is stunning. There's a V-shaped valley with one, two, three ridges, and then beyond those ridges is a mountain. And there's slithers of snow on the top of it. Could I just ask your first name?
Nassim.
How are you finding life at the moment?
Iftizah.
Terrible.
Terrible. Are you worried about a potential war between America and Iran?
It makes no difference to me, but maybe it would even be better for us if a war happened.
Well, why would it be better if a war happened?
It might actually lead to a basic or principal change in our ruling system, and it might lead to a better situation. But if it's going to lead into a civil war, no, it's not going to be good at all.
People head up into the mountains to get away from all the stresses of daily life. But we're heading back down the mountain now, and soon we'll be in the city. And Iranians will be reminded of the struggles with sanctions and the rising tensions across the region. For now, anyway, there is no escape from it in Iran.
Martin Patience reporting from Iran. Kosovo's prime minister has resigned after prosecutors at a special war crimes court in The Hague called him in for questioning. Ramush Haradinaj, who was a commander of the Kosovo Liberation Army during the war for independence from Serbia, said he decided to step down as leader and face the tribunal as an ordinary Kosovan.
I've informed the government that I've resigned irrevocably as prime minister. The reason for this is because of a summons I've received from a specialist court as a suspect. I was given the option to go as the Prime Minister or as an ordinary citizen of Kosovo. To preserve the honour of the government and the state, I thought it was right to make this decision.
Mr. Haradinaj had also resigned as Prime Minister in 2005 when he was facing trial at the UN War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. He was later cleared. So what might the Kosovo specialist prosecutor want to question him about now? I asked our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay.
Well, it's worth saying the special court is keeping shtum on this. It's not saying who it's questioning and it hasn't made any indictments. But the special court was set up 3 years ago to investigate crimes against humanity, which may have been committed by the former leaders of the Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA. And now the KLA were involved in a conflict in the late 1990s with Yugoslav forces who were directed by the notorious Serb nationalist President Slobodan Milosevic. And there have always been allegations since that time that the KLA were involved in crimes against humanity. The most serious allegations involved the harvesting and trafficking of human organs, and there have also been allegations that the KLA was involved in the murder of civilians.
But Mr. Haradinaj has already been charged and cleared by the Hague Tribunal. So is this looking at a different part of the past?
It's an interesting question because the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia did operate for almost two decades. And Mr. Haradinaj was on trial there twice. And on those occasions, it was involved with the targeting of civilians during that conflict in the late 1990s. He was acquitted on both occasions. The second occasion was actually a retrial because the judges ruled there'd been witness intimidation in the first trial. He was acquitted, though, both occasions. The last time was in 2012. Mr. Haradinaj's name wasn't the first one that came up, it has to be said, when people were talking about which senior leaders of Kosovo might face prosecution by this special court. But it could well be that they have found what they believe is fresh evidence for offences which haven't been prosecuted by the ICTY, and that's why we're seeing Mr. Haradinaj going to The Hague for questioning now.
And what does his resignation mean for Kosovo? It hasn't had the most stable period recently.
No, it hasn't. And you could actually look at this, if you were to be cynical, heaven forfend that one should be cynical about politics in the Balkans, but you could look at this as a move in Kosovo's domestic politics, because Mr. Haradinaj has been in an ongoing power struggle with the president of Kosovo, Hashim Thaçi. Now, both these men were former leaders of the Kosovo Liberation Army, as were many senior politicians in Kosovo. But the key here is that Mr. Haradinaj would like to govern without having to make his uneasy alliance with Mr. Thaçi. And he's already called on the president to order fresh elections. And he would perhaps be hoping to leverage his appearance in The Hague for more support for him and his party in any national elections. That's a cynical interpretation, but it's quite possible.
Guy Delaunay, our Balkans correspondent. YouTube plays a big part in many people's lives, whether for entertainment, education or self-help. So when the head of YouTube here in Britain offered to talk to the BBC about the future, we were intrigued. Ben McCone-Wilson spoke to our technology reporter, Chris Fox.
I think the reason that YouTube wanted to talk to us is because in the UK, we're going to have new regulations come in about online harms. The Culture Secretary said online platforms haven't done enough to tackle the consequences of hate speech and extremist content, and now they want to bring in new regulations. And I think YouTube is a little bit nervous about this. They want to be clear that anything too overbearing could act as censorship, and they want to get the message out there that they are doing a lot in their view already, and that it would be impossible to check everything.
And so what do they fear in terms of regulation?
Well, one of the fears with regulation is who draws up the policies and who is checking it. First of all, they already use human moderators and machines to take down videos that break their existing rules. But you can't check everything. There are 500 hours of content uploaded to YouTube every minute. That is a phenomenal amount of video information. You can't pre-check everything. Now, YouTube's view is that it is an open platform, and you either accept that we have an open platform where anyone can post whatever they like. Sometimes that might be radical, or it might be racist, or it might be homophobic, and it has to be removed if it breaks the rules. The opposite to that is you don't have an open platform, everything is pre-checked, and not everyone has access to it. I suppose like the old mainstream media used to be. So YouTube's view is it would like to stay open, but there are, of course, consequences for that. And I put the question to Mr. McCone-Wilson about what would be the worst case scenario.
What we ought to be worried about is decisions being taken in a darkened room by unnamed individuals around who gets a right to speak and to make their thoughts and views available to the public. I think that is what we should all be afraid of. We might end up in those places, and at that point we would have to take a decision on whether it would be appropriate for YouTube to continue to operate in those. We're not available in China, we're not available in Sudan, we're not available in a bunch of markets where we've been unable to work with governments to agree a set of rules that don't subject us to censorship.
So it sounds like a threat to walk away if regulation is too tight there. I mean, how does YouTube look compared to others like Facebook?
Well, Facebook has also said previously that it welcomes the idea of regulation because it can't solve all the problems on its own. And really, there isn't a straightforward answer. If you accept that people should have a right to be able to post whatever they like on the internet up until a certain point, then you have to accept that some people will use that to do bad things. YouTube has made the threat to switch off its platform before. They were worried about new EU proposals around copyright, which was known as Article 13. Well, that got passed by the EU and they still haven't switched off the platform. So maybe it's a little bit of a hollow threat. Ultimately, I don't think they want to face huge fines what company does.
Chris Fox. Algeria has won the Africa Cup of Nations, beating Senegal 1-0. It's the second time they've won the tournament. More than 10,000 Algerians travelled to the final in Cairo, from where Matthew Kenyon reports.
A second continental crown for Algeria was secured with a freak goal in the second minute of the final. Baghdad Bounedjah's shot deflected off Salif Sané's outstretched leg and looped over the stranded keeper for the only goal of the game. Senegal forced one fine save from the Algeria keeper but created little else. They were awarded a penalty for handball in the second half, but that was then overturned after the intervention of the video assistant referee, and Algeria closed things out to spark celebrations from the huge Algerian contingent in the crowd in the Cairo International Stadium. It's 29 years since Algeria won their first title, and this second success has been richly deserved in Egypt. For Senegal, though, the wait goes on. Now twice runners-up, they have still never been crowned as champions of Africa.
Matthew Kenyon. And still to come on the podcast. After more than 800 years, the first woman is allowed to count the Queen's swans on the River Thames. Aid agencies are calling for a speedier response to the Ebola emergency in the Democratic Republic of Congo. More than 1,600 people have died already, and the World Health Organization has declared an international public health emergency. Vaccination programs are continuing in the city of Goma, where a priest died from Ebola on Monday. From there, our correspondent Anne Soy sent this report.
Bonjour. A little boy is just washing his hands at the entrance to a health facility on the outskirts of Goma. This is the Afia Himbi Health Center. And to my right, I can see about a dozen people sitting under a red tent waiting to be vaccinated. These are people who came into direct contact with their pastor who arrived in Goma displaying symptoms of Ebola. They've come here to be vaccinated against the disease. There are also people who are in contact with those contacts. It's called a ring vaccination.
My name is Jonathan. I was in contact with someone who was in the same bus as the Ebola patient. That's the bus driver. He is my uncle. He came home. Later we learned that one of his passengers had Ebola. My uncle has also been vaccinated.
My name is Julian. I was in contact with someone who was on that bus. He was sent to deliver something to my family. Because we're his contacts, my entire family is here to be vaccinated.
Since the beginning of this outbreak, more than 165,000 Congolese have been vaccinated. Other countries have also taken up the vaccination program. Uganda vaccinated more than 5,000 health workers even before the outbreak was declared there. The vaccine is still experimental, but health experts say that they believe it has contributed in a big way to preventing further spread of the disease. But it's also voluntary. That means that not everyone who should get it is getting it.
Anne Soy in the Congolese city of Goma. A court in France has rejected a $45 million claim for compensation from survivors and relatives of the victims of the worst peacetime disaster in European seas. 852 people died when the MS Estonia sank in 1994 while crossing from Tallinn to Stockholm. The court ruling means a French certification agency and a German shipbuilder will not have to pay damages. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
This was a group action brought by more than 1,000 survivors of the sinking and family members of victims. They were asking for millions of euros in compensation for the suffering caused by the disaster and needed to prove that there'd been gross negligence in the design, maintenance and inspection of the Estonia. The ship sank in heavy seas after water burst through the bow doors, leading to the car deck. But the court in Paris ruled that no blame could be attributed to the builder of the ship or to the certification agency, bringing to an end a court battle that's lasted nearly a quarter of a century.
Hugh Schofield there. Celebrations will be taking place this weekend to mark the 50th anniversary of one of the greatest achievements of the last century, man landing on the moon. NASA's Apollo 11 lunar landing continues to inspire scientists and astronauts. Here in London, an exhibition has opened at the National Maritime Museum charting our historical, cultural and scientific relationship with the moon. Jackie Leonard spoke to the curator, Melanie Vandenbroek.
The first object in the exhibition is a tiny etching by William Blake, a British 18th century artist, in which he represents a tiny little figure about to embark on a journey to the moon. There's a ladder that is joining the Earth and the moon, and he's about to step on this ladder, whilst two other figures in the background are huddled together in fear as to this momentous task that he's embarking on.
So we have now moved into the more modern era, the point at which we actually travel to the moon. There are lots of objects here. There is a model of the rocket itself, but there is also over there I can see an alien, and there are cartoons and there are modern artworks. Tell us about this section.
So we are in the third section of the exhibition called Destination Moon, which does what it say on the tin. It's about going to the moon. One of my favourite objects in the exhibition is a spectacular poster for Fritz Lang's 1929 silent film Frau im Mond, The Woman in the Moon. You can see a soaring rocket just going to the stars on its way to the moon. The movie was prescient in many ways, and I find it really fascinating how the art leads the science and the science leads the art.
It's interesting that it's Frau im Mond, woman in
the moon, yes. And of course, there's still no woman on the moon to this day. But I think, again, he's being quite prescient because we think that probably the next person to step on the moon, certainly NASA's chief said so a few days ago, will be a woman.
Tell me a little bit about what's in this case.
This is a fancy dress astronaut's helmet, which was made by an 8-year-old Richard Blundell in Maidenhead in 1969 in his kitchen with his mum. Apparently, they were following guidelines from the British TV show Blue Peter, who showed viewers how to make such a helmet. And what I found great about it is how it expresses beautifully, and it's a fantastic work of craftsmanship too. It expresses beautifully how everybody was at it.
Everything to do with the moon landings, it did bleed over, didn't it? It did affect all sorts of aspects of popular culture, how people talked about each other, about the world.
Absolutely. The moon landings, the space race completely permeated popular culture. And in fact, in the exhibition, we have toys, we have wallpaper designs, we have furnishings, we have fashion. It really shows the ways that people wanted to be part of this incredible experiment. They wanted to contribute to it, and they had memorabilia in their home afterwards as well. They had plates, they collected magazines, they had a record so that they could listen over and over to the first words of the first man on the moon. Everybody wanted a piece of the moon at home, as it were.
Despite helping to beat New Zealand to win the World Cup on Sunday, the English cricketer Ben Stokes has been nominated for the New Zealander of the Year Award. He's eligible because he was born in New Zealand, moving to England when he was 12. The award's chief judge said that although Stokes had broken Kiwi hearts, there were clearly a few New Zealanders who thought they could claim him. More from our sports correspondent Alex Capstick.
He was largely responsible for denying the country of his birth a first World Cup triumph. But despite the agonising nature of the defeat, it would seem New Zealand is not a nation to hold grudges. Instead, they're claiming Ben Stokes as one of their own by nominating him as Kiwi of the Year. The award is given to those who have made a significant contribution to their nation, someone to make them proud. Ben Stokes, with his man-of-the-match performance at Lord's, broke their hearts. But he's got some stiff competition. The New Zealand captain, Kane Williamson, who is named Player of the Tournament, is also a contender for the prize.
Alex Capstick. It's one of those curious British traditions that dates back centuries. But until now, swan upping has been strictly the preserve of men. Every summer for hundreds of years, groups of men have rowed along the River Thames to catch and count swans. But on Thursday, a woman was invited to join them for the first time. Richard Hamilton reports.
The earliest reference to swan upping was in 1186, a few years before Richard the Lionheart joined the Crusades. Originally, the practice involved catching swans that belonged to the royal family so they could be eaten. Nowadays, it's more about conservation and checking that the birds are healthy. The honour of being the very first female to take part in this ancient ritual has been given to an American. Karen Hammond donned the traditional red shirt and white trousers of the swan uppers and joined 18 men in 6 wooden boats. She told me what a swan upper does.
You row in boats called skiffs, and there are 6 boats altogether. When you see a brood, a family of swans, one of the men in the boat will call all up, and we form a circle around the swans. And we catch the cygnets and the swans, the parents, and just put them up onto shore. We tie their feet and their wings loosely. But, you know, they're not hurt in any way. And the swan marker will come by and tag the cygnets, and we check them for injuries and measure their beaks and weigh them, and then they're all let go at once.
Karen didn't come across any swans in South Dakota, where she grew up, but came to appreciate their beauty after moving to England. She'd been invited by the Queen's official swan marker, David Barber, who lives in the same village in Berkshire. He chose her because of her expertise in rowing. Local children are also invited to watch the swan uppers and are taught about the history, the required skills, and the importance of conservation in the hope that this tradition will continue for future generations.
Richard Hamilton. Before we go, a reminder of another BBC World Service podcast you may like.
I like that.
I don't think I like that.
This is the sound of crowd science.
Those very alarming sounds are... It's quite normal.
This is what women want. They want a man that can eat a stick.
I have a brilliant trowel.
That's tiny.
What you should see now is a cloud.
No way.
Each week, the Crowd Science podcast answers your questions about life, Earth, and the universe.
Are there foreseeable limits to knowledge?
It's an excellent question. Actually, it's a very deep question.
With the help of scientists around the world who are trying to find new answers themselves.
We think that people have a little more control over their brainwaves than they think they do.
That's Crowd Science from the BBC World Service.
We smash things together and we'll see what happens.
Just search for Crowd Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You've got brain freeze.
And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.